Hello, everybody. This is Wade with Wade for Wireless again. And today, I dabbled a little bit, so I thought I'd start out with an intro today. I've interviewed Kevin Kidd, and he basically runs his companies, which is KK Broadcast Company and AM Ground Systems. And his website's amgroundsystems.com. I'll put it in the show notes. It'll be there for you guys to, if you want to click on the link and do anything with it, in my blog. And but what I wanted to do was, here's a guy that, not necessarily a tower climber, he's a broadcast engineer. And what he's out at broadcast sites all the time, so he has no way to get to these sites other than walk through the woods, you know, or just be out in the brush, or, you know, to get to the shelter. Because a lot of his sites in the southeast are out in the middle of fields and such. He does a lot of AM broadcast and FM broadcast. So all you carrier guys out there, this will be very interesting. Because when you're working around broadcast, it's a different world. And the reason I had him on was because from a tick bite, he got Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And I did the post about Bruce Holsted, who I'm trying to get a hold of. I'm hoping to have him on the show. And I just want to show you guys what to look for in case you get this. And just because you get bit by a tick doesn't mean you get it. Just because you don't think you got bit by a tick doesn't mean you won't get it. Because he said a tick can come up and just bite you and then decide, you know, they don't like your blood type. And then move on and you can still get it. And he goes through a lot of let's say, old wives' tales about how, you know, you want to pull the head out, you want to put Vaseline on or whatever, nail polish and make him back out. He basically, after talking to the doctor and everything, he said that was crap. So he said, basically, you just want to get it out of you and then you can dig the head out. He said, once it bites you, it's too late. Now, the good news is it didn't affect him like it did Bruce. You know, he was very uncomfortable. They actually thought he had shingles, but he didn't lose work over it. He just had to put up with, like, headaches and pain. And he explains that it's actually a parasite that's in your blood that gives you this fever and the reactions that you get. And it all depends how long you let it go, obviously, and how it affects you. Now, if you're on the East Coast, the doctors are more familiar with, say, Lyme disease, tick bites, Rocky Mountain spotted fever. They're more familiar with those diseases. If you're on the West Coast, I'm talking in the U.S. here. If you're on the West Coast, I just heard from a guy the other day, they're not familiar with it. Maybe there's a little more awareness now, but he actually had Lyme disease, and I think it was years till they figured out what he had. And it's because he came to the East Coast and he got a tick bite, pulled the tick out, forgot about it. Anyway, and I also have links at the end of the show that is all about the disease, how you get it, if you get bit by a tick, you know, what to look for. And the other thing they say, I'm going to bring this up because I find it interesting, is that if you think about it, obviously, if you can, they want you to save the tick and freeze it. It's just something as a precaution that you can take the bug in, I guess, if you see a doctor and they can see if it's infected or not. Now, that's on the website. You guys can get on the website. You can make up your own mind. You know, it's a little gross to have a tick in your freezer for a long time. They show a pill bottle, but I think the reality is, you know, you use a Ziploc or something and put him in there and freeze. Once he's frozen, he's dead. But I get what they're saying. You get bit by a tick, you save it. But the reality is most of you guys are out at tower sites, and you're not going to be able to necessarily hold on to a tick that long unless you have some Ziplocs. You could put them in the Ziploc and take them back with you. And then once you get somewhere, you know, home, you can put them in a freezer, get back to your hotel room, wherever you are. I know a lot of you guys travel a lot. But the idea, the reason I wanted to have Kevin on is so you guys would know what to look for in case you got this disease. And they can treat it pretty quick and pretty, well, not easy, but they can treat it quickly. It takes about a week of antibiotics. And Kevin goes into that. And Kevin also talks a little bit about the broadcast industry, which is interesting because I have a podcast and, you know, the AM and FM has a lot of competition, not only from satellite radio, but also from, you know, podcasts and the internet. You know, people just don't listen to live radio as much as they used to, except for live events like sports. a lot of people listen to radio for sporting events and for anything live, maybe a concert or something that happens live, news. But I think broadcast is essential for emergencies. I mean, let's face it, if there's an emergency, a lot of people get their news off the internet, but they usually turn on the TV to see what's going on in real time or listen to the radio to see what's going on in real time. Same as traffic. People may look on the internet for traffic, but if you're driving, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, I know they have traffic built into a lot of GPSs, but, you know, is it necessarily real time? With that said, sometimes you listen to a station and, you know, you're already in the jam till they mention the traffic jam. So it goes either way. Just got to listen to it at the right time, I guess. So with all that said, I am going to stop talking, at least to you, and I'm going to go to the call, which I edited out a little bit just because we're both on cell phones and it's a little rough to talk that way. But yeah, this is Kevin Kidd, and again, KK Broadcast Company and AM Ground Systems, and he's a great guy. Kevin's a great guy just from talking to him here. He's a broadcast engineer. He's been around. You know, he's on call 24/7. Puts up with a lot of crap, but he figures his way out of it to repair all this stuff for these station owners. And he's doing pretty well for as much as budgets have been cut. So he appears to be a good businessman as well. All right, without further ado, here's a call.
But yes, I have had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and yes, it was fairly unpleasant, although it was nothing like the case that Bruce Olmstead had. Where that he'd been fighting for 3 years.
Oh, yeah. Bruce's situation, that was severe. I just can't believe how bad off he was. Poor guy.
Now, that's Rocky Mountain spotted fever, as it turns out. Of course, it's very common, and a lot of people have it and get over it and don't really even know what they had. But it's one of the most, according to my doctor and the our local health department, it's one of the most misdiagnosed diseases in especially the Southeast, I assume the other parts of the world where deer ticks live and where the disease is active. But it has many, many symptoms, and it varies from person to person what symptoms you have.
Wow. Did you get spots like they say you get? Did you get spots all over?
I got I was broke out, and I have a fair number of allergies to a number of different things, but I don't really break out that much. Most of it, you know, head allergies and sinus problems and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but I broke out literally almost 100% of my body with this angry red rash, but I also had several breakouts, and it was very uncomfortable for me because it was down the backs of my legs and up my rump and up my lower back. As a matter of fact, when the first time the doctor looked at me, she thought that I might have shingles. But,
oh,
of course, as it turns out, that was not it. And occasionally, over some of the breakouts that I had, I did have just a dull, bad headache, and I almost never have headaches. But that's one of the symptoms, one of the many, many symptoms of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Just, I guess it depends on what part of the brain or where the parasite is actually working on you. But it's also one of the, again, according to my doctor, one of the only things that will make you, your hands and the palms of your hands and the bottoms of your feet break out.
Oh.
And that's how she actually, I was sitting up on the table, and I hadn't been to the doctor a lot, but had been three or four times, I guess, over 2 or 3 months. And I was sitting up on the table, and she had, was about to give me another steroid dose pack, which I like. Yeah, boy, you just feel sick. Like you may not be getting any better, but you sure do feel a lot better. And she was about to write me another prescription for that, just thinking that it was my allergies. I was building a shop at the time, and they were using, of course, a lot of treated wood and paints and solvents and that kind of thing. She just thought that I probably was having a reaction to some of that. and I was sitting on the examination table. She walked back in, and I was sitting there scratching the palms of my hand. I'd had a breakout the day before, but the most of the rash was gone. You could still see it a little bit on my arms, and she got me down and started inspecting my palms, and said, "You've got rock spotted fever." And I said, "Oh, crap, but what's how bad is that?" And I said, "Well, it's probably not too bad that you don't seem to be having any problems now." But she wrote me a prescription for tetracycline, a heavy-duty antibiotic, and that was pretty unpleasant, but it seemed to clear it up. And then, oh, 3 or 4 or 5 months later, I had either a relapse or another case. Don't know which. No way to know which. And I had to go back for another round of tetracycline. All so, tore up tummy and sunburn. You have to be real careful taking it, not being out in the sun. When you work outside for a living, that's kind of hard to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's next to impossible if you're anywhere outside. But so, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, you said, is that actually a parasite? Or is it what is it? Is it a parasite or is it a disease?
It is a disease, but it's caused by a parasite that you get from a deer tick. And a deer tick is one of the ticks that has a little white spot in the middle of its back. We have brown dog ticks. We've got the little tiny ticks. We've got deer ticks, although we haven't saw any deer ticks this year. But if the deer ticks that, for whatever reason, I don't know why, it's only that particular kind of tick, but that particular tick carries the Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And I think Lyme disease as well. I'm not absolutely certain about that, but I believe it's also the carrier of Lyme disease.
Yeah, I know the deer tick carries Lyme disease. So, yeah, it is the deer tick.
And contrary to popular belief, growing up, I always heard, oh, you've got to make him back out and do all kinds of things. You put Vaseline on it, try to make him back out, or a hot match to his butt and try to make him back out. As it turns out, that is absolutely, totally an old wives' tale, false old wives' tale. And that it doesn't matter, a tick that's infected with the parasite can walk up your leg, find a nice place, sit down, chew on you for a few minutes, and decide, hey, this is not for me, and back out and go on his way and fall off to infect somebody else, and you have the disease.
Oh, that's good to know. I didn't know that. I thought they had to be all the way in you, and I thought it was when you pulled them out. So that's not true.
No, it's when they bite you. Now, the longer they stay on you, the more likely an infected tick. The longer they stay on you, the more likely you are to get it. But a infected tick can walk up your leg or anywhere and bite you, and just get knocked off or fall off, and you can still get the disease from that. Now, getting the head out is kind of important, but only from a infection, what have you, standpoint. If you leave the head in, yes, you very likely may have a little infected spot pop up that you're going to have to deal with. But now if I find a tick stuck down on me, I just rip him off and deal with the consequences later, because there's no benefit to spending a lot of time trying to make him back out. It's not going to save you from Rocky Mountain spotted fever or Lyme disease, either one.
Okay. I'm just taking some notes. So, do you get tests on you all the time? Do you know the day you got infected? I mean, you have any idea, or is it just one of those things that, you got a couple bites and like a month later, you felt sick? I mean, how was that? How was that process? I mean, I'm just curious, because if you look down and you have a tick in you, and you pull it out, yeah, I know you don't get sick right away. How long does it take, or how long did it take you to find out you were sick? Or you have no idea. Maybe you don't know.
I don't have a clue. I hadn't had a tick stuck down on me that I had found for probably a couple of 3 months. that I could remember at the time anyway. So I don't have a clue when I was actually bitten.
Wow.
But there again, you know, I may have got a tick on me and it started to set down and burrow in, and then decided, yeah, no, this, I don't like the taste of this dude, and backed out, fell off, and I went on to infect somebody else. But no, I don't have a clue what or when I was actually infected. And it takes, I think it's like 45 to 60 days, maybe less than that, for the parasite to start actually multiplying enough to start making you sick. But it will literally sneak up on you, because I didn't, having absolutely no idea that I'd even been bitten. That was, if I'd have pulled a tick off of me at some point in time, I probably would have thought to say, hey, you know, I got a tick off of me 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So, wow. It's just something to think about. You could get bit and never know. Because I pulled ticks off of me, and I always looked for that bread mark. You know, they always say the bullseye mark. But in your case, none of that ever happened.
Not that I know of, no. No, I never had a bullseye. Of course, the bullseye is more related to Lyme's disease, as I understand it.
Yeah.
There are a number of ticks on me, especially the little tiny, teeny tiny seed ticks. I don't know if you're familiar with those. They're tiny. They actually make a worse spot on me than does the bigger ticks. And almost every time that I have one of them sit down on me, I end up with what I guess could be mistaken for the bullseye, because I end up with a red spot about the size of a nickel, I guess, kind of a bruised-looking spot that comes up and then like a week later disappears.
Okay.
But the Lyme disease bullseye is really kind of looks different from that. I've never had it, thankfully. But right now, we have a couple of three friends that all have Lyme disease. And as it turns out, didn't really know it, but they all, two of them had worked for the same, at the same place, kind of a farm. And another one had done work there, some construction work there. So they're now looking into that to see if there's a horde of infected ticks at that location.
But, okay. Well, that would make sense. You know, it seems to make sense.
But for those of us who, I live in the woods, my shop is in the woods, my, working on broadcast stations, I have to go through the woods, walk through the woods. You know, you never know what you're going to get into. And I've just tried to be more observant and notice if I have a tick stuck down on me and make a mental note of it, and if start having any of the symptoms, then try to remember that. But that's, as I said in one of those emails I had sent quite a bit earlier, if you start having high unexplained fever, unexplained headaches, breaking out from one end to the other, and several other symptoms that are never explained, make your doctor do a Rocky Mountain spotted fever test, because there is a possibility that may be what it is, even though you have never thought that you had a tick on you.
Wow. Yeah, it's something to think about. Did you lose any work? I mean, was it that bad? I know you were uncomfortable. You probably felt like crap with that rash in the heat.
I didn't lose any work. I was already self-employed at the time, so I didn't lose any work. I was miserable there for a few days. Thankfully, the rash typically only lasted a day or two.
Oh, really?
I would break out. I might leave right now, leave the shop, and look and feel fine, and a couple of 3 hours later, be itching and scratching and couldn't hardly stand to sit and drive. And of course, that was in the early summer, so it was hot. And you know, driving, you get hot and sweaty, and it was very uncomfortable. But oddly enough, the steroids, I could start taking the steroids one day, and usually by the next day, the rash would almost be completely gone. and usually within that next day, it would be completely gone. So it wasn't like it was a, you know, contained like Bruce's ordeal where he was literally crippled. I wasn't that bad, but, you know, it was miserable, yes, but it wasn't. Honestly, the 3 weeks of antibiotics was actually made me sicker and made me feel worse than the affliction. The cure was worse than the affliction.
Oh, yeah. You know, I wonder if Bruce's was worse because he went undiagnosed for a long time. You know what I mean? I wonder if that was a problem.
Yeah, very possible. And, you know, it could have been it just affected him differently, or it the parasite attacked a different part of him differently. I don't have a clue. There's no way. But I would say probably that going undiagnosed for a long time would probably make it certainly worse.
Yeah. How are you today? I mean, any side effects? Is it completely gone, you think, or you think it could come back?
Well, I'm fine. Since I got the email from you this weekend, I was trying to remember, and the only thing I can think of was I had a 2001 Dodge truck. I remember the truck that I was driving at the time, so it was somewhere probably around 2001. And other than having either the second case or the relapse about 6 months later, I haven't had any symptoms whatsoever. I'm arthritic, but I don't think that has anything to do with it.
Huh. Hey, so what do you do now? I mean, I know you work at AM stations, but I'm not sure exactly. Why don't you tell us what you do?
I'm a broadcast engineer. I work on about 30 stations. I do technical work for about 30 stations through Middle Tennessee, North Alabama, stretched all the way over into the very, I guess, southwest corner of North Carolina, and all the way in the almost Memphis. And, of course, I don't work those every day, but my regular clients are all within about 40 or 50 miles of me. And then we do consulting work and project work anywhere in the country, mostly on AM stations, although we do some FM work. But the project work, we kind of specialize in AM rebuilds and repairs and full builds, turnkey.
Do you do maintenance? Are you on call?
Yes, I'm on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
All those stations. When a storm rolls through, how do you keep up?
Well, sometimes, depending on the storm, at least when I first started working, of course, I started with one station, and then a year or two later had two stations, and then a year or so later had, you know, two or three, four or more, and it's built way up to what we do now. But, yeah, sometimes when a storm goes through, it's an interesting life. We have, over the years, been able to convince the owners, and of course, radio owners are notorious for, well, I'll get to that later. And later, of course, never comes. And, you know, we need to do this. We need to drive this many ground rods and get this much copper strap and ground everything together. And we can get rid of most of your lightning problems. Yeah, we'll look at doing that here sometime later on this spring. Well, later on this spring never comes. And then they have another great big lightning strike. Well, what can we do to fix this? Yeah, okay, we need to address, you know, it's that kind of thing. But over the years, I've been able to convince most of the our clients that if you do this, you will not be having to call me in the middle of the night after just a little thunderstorm rolls across. And that's pretty much been true. And I finally, the first, half of my career, I started working on broadcast stations in 83. For about the first half of that, the first 15 years, I made the terrible, terrible mistake of allowing the owners, station owners, to put my phone numbers in the dial-up remote controls from the transmitter size.
Yeah, so you're getting calls all the time at night.
Oh, all night. I mean, a little storm rolled across, you know, the power blink, And I could track storms as they went across just from all the calls from all these remote controls. And I finally got across to the owners that, okay, as of a certain date, I'm no longer going to be doing it. I would love to do it for you, and I will do it for you, but I'm going to charge you by the call. It's going to be 2 hours every time the phone rings. Do you want me to do it or not? And most of them decided, no, they would learn how to take care of it. And now, you know, it was the difference between 25-plus at the time stations with calling me and those 25 stations each calling only one person. You know, the owner, he might get one or two calls a night. Well, I might get one or two calls a night from 25 stations. So most of them decided that they would start monitoring their own transmitters and taking their own readings and even as far as going to check trip breakers and that kind of thing. So it really lightened my storm work up. When we did that, it was it was pretty interesting on some of those stormy southern nights, which you know, we've been having quite a bit here lately.
Yeah, this year has been rough with the weather. You know, we had a rough winter, and now we're having a rough. I don't know. I'm just north of the Mason-Dixon, and up here we've just had a ton of storms roll through, thunder and lightning storms. You know, they whip up quick. It's just the way the year's gone. So I imagine down there, I know you guys get a lot more lightning than we do up here. So,
yeah, it's been we haven't really had a tremendous amount of lightning damage, thankfully, but I attribute a lot of that to being that we've also had a lot of rain.
Yeah.
And, of course, a ground, be it a FM ground dean or a AM ground system, they are much, much more effective when the ground is wet. Where we have a lot of damage here, we have a 3 weeks of dry weather, and then have one little supercell come across that produces a tremendous amount of. It may produce a tremendous amount of rain, but it also produces a tremendous amount of lightning, and. If something gets hit before the ground gets moist again, then there's really no place for the lightning energy to go. So that's really where a lot of our problems come from down here is the ground will be extremely dry, and then we'll have a thunderstorm come across.
Okay. God bless you. Being on call all the time, I know what it was like. It's rough, but it sounds like you got it under control, so. Sounds like you talked the owners into doing the right thing with the grounding. That's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like you did things right down there. So.
Well, yeah, that, of course, you know, we still have lightning strikes, but they're typically more manageable than what they have been in the past, just due to that. And, of course, also relatable of half-blown-up junk anyway over the last number of years.
Yeah, I would imagine everything's. Well, I don't know, but I mean, I know a lot of broadcast engineers I talk to. A lot of them have upgraded here within the past 5 years compared to the old days when they kept transmitters for 30 or 40 years. I think now most of them up here anyway are less than 5 years old. How is it like the ones you take care of? Is it pretty much the same story?
Well, not necessarily 5 years, but. About the last 10 or 12 years, we have replaced practically every old AM transmitter, and I'm talking transmitters from the 50s
that
have been replaced in the last 10 or 12 years. And most of the ownership, we drug them into the 20th century kicking and screaming, and then... And then after they got about their second or third electric bill from the transmitter and said, hey, wow, boy, that's nice. modern AM transmitters, solid-state transmitters, they run at like 80, 85, sometimes even a little better efficiency.
Yeah.
And whereas old transmitters, well, the plate efficiency on them might be fairly high, but you still had to heat the tubes. You still had all the blowers running. You had all the overhead, whether you were making a watt or not. And the owners have finally were really glad that they have replaced them. And of course, now solid state FM transmitters are getting to be very mature, and it's come to the point where, and on top of that, power tubes, like you find in AM tube type transmitters and FM tube type transmitters, are all junk. even brand new tubes. I can order a brand new iMac tube and put it in a otherwise transmitter that's otherwise operating fine. And if you go back and look at the hour log on the transmitter, 20 years ago, you might have been able to get 2 years, 2.5 years of a tube. If you put exactly the same tube in that transmitter now, and all things being equal, it's you're only going to see possibly a year to a year and a half out of the tube.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They're, the tubes are junk, and especially rebuild tubes. The rebuilt tubes are they've been rebuilt many times, and they're just junk. So the change to solid-state transmitters is something that, other than the extremely high power FM, even the 50 kilowatt AMs, it's much, and actually that's where you really see the biggest improvement in efficiency. But the high power FMs is about the only thing that's left that a tube actually does better than solid state.
Wow. It's just funny, with tubes, I guess years ago, you know, I just think they were built better. Obviously now, I don't even know where you'd get a tube. I mean, where do you get tubes for AM and FM? I mean, they used to come out of Russia, remember?
Oh, yeah.
They just wouldn't make them in the States.
We used a lot of the Svetlana tubes, and of course now there's ProTech, and they're made in China. There's most tubes, unless they're an iMac tube. iMac is still made in the U.S., but they're no better than any of the rest of them. ProTech tubes, and there's quite a number for them, but they're all made in China and probably Russia as well. But they're all very, very low quality, very, very low life, and a problem from the start. And, of course, you know, the transmitters are getting ancient, and some of the manufacturers are still selling fairly low-powered FM tube-type transmitters, but the tubes, all right, the transmitters are fine. It's the tubes that are the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cheap tubes.
Yeah, I have a client over in North Carolina that is a good friend and a good client, but we were trying to get him to replace a very aging AM transmitter and a FM transmitter as well, but also doing some other work for him. This was just a couple of years ago. We were getting some things done for him that had needed to have been done for about 40 years. One day he said, you know, if we keep on, we're going to bring this place into the 20th century. But that's a good thing, because we're now in the 21st century.
Yeah, you're only a century behind.
He kind of looked funny. Wow, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, he didn't realize he's a century behind.
He's still a century behind, but
but it's still an improvement, right?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So I guess broadcast has been pretty good to you down there. It's still going strong, right? I mean, how is business? I mean, I know you have a lot of stations under your belt, but is business still pretty good with all of them?
Well, repair business actually is okay. Project work is practically non-existent.
Oh.
Stations, the economy is so bad, and radio, I'm afraid, takes, well, radio and TV both, because I don't do TV. TV is something you do with a cold adult beverage and a recliner. but the when businesses, you know, like your friendly local grocer, when they start having financial problems, many times the first thing they do is cut out their advertising.
Yeah.
Of course, that's what radio lives on is advertising. And it's been a bad 6 or 7 years for radio, and most radio stations aren't doing anything that they absolutely don't have to. They're not expanding. They're not really, not really doing anything that's not required for day-to-day operation. So project work is has been very, very slow the last couple or 3 years. But oddly enough, our local maintenance work has actually been, if anything, more busy than what it has been in probably 6 or 8 years. We're not really building anything, not building any new studios or anything else. It's just that doing some upgrades and what have you. So that's been a blessing that did have that end of the business to go on. But in general, radio in general is in bad shape.
Yeah. You think they're going to make changes to it? You think they can do anything to revive it, or what do you think will happen? You think, I mean, with the internet now, a lot of people listen over the internet. You think that's the way things are going to go? I mean, we still need broadcast. I mean, that's how people get their information, especially at emergencies. Let's face it, you can't live without it. But,
yeah.
I mean, it just seems like now everyone listens to, you know, their iPod or phone or something, or the internet. You know, that's how things are done.
Well, that's what radio stations have had to change their business model and start paying more attention to their internet operations and their online stuff. Some stations do as much by their online presence as they do by their own air presence. And, you know, there's a lot more outlets out there. You know, 40 years ago, most little wide spot in the road towns had a radio station. Well, now every wide spot in the road is counting all the podcasts and the satellite radio and what have you, has got 15 or 20 that people might want to listen to each. So, you know, radio has really had to do some modification, and it's as much anything in just their thought pattern. But AM in particular is going to have to make some changes. Of course, the FCC took comments on the AM revitalization. They took those comments this spring, and there was quite a number of good comments, and some of them were pretty space cadet. But there are several different things in the pipe that I would say the FCC probably will go ahead with. I think they're probably going to grant a one-time window and allow AM stations to apply for an FM translator, which they started allowing 2 or 3 years ago. And you see, there are several things in the pipeline that they are probably going to approve sooner rather than later, I hope. And we only hope that they don't do it like they did the AM stereo and just literally allow AM stereo to die on the vine by not making a decision. They killed it by not making a decision.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was that was really a mess, where they allowed the market to decide which system was going to be. They didn't want to face the lawsuits. That's what it amounted to be. Motorola was the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and then you had Kahn and you had Harris and some of the other companies that were put forth viable AM stereo systems, and they knew that Motorola would litigate or legislate to the point that they didn't want to put up with all the flack, and they literally made the statement they would allow the market to determine the victor, and it ended up going to Motorola, of course, but that took 3 or 4 years, and most systems weren't really compatible. So for that length of time, radios weren't being produced, and it kind of died on the vine as a result of the indecision of the FCC at the time.
Well, I don't know. I'm curious to see what's going to happen, because AM and even FM broadcast, you know, they're in a pickle because they have so much competition. Like you said, SiriusXM, the internet. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. But I think live sports is still the big thing. I think they – or a live event. You know what I'm trying to say? Like any live event, if they would concentrate on that, do you think that would help? Do you think that would change the industry? I mean, do you think it's just a programming issue, or do you think they can just change it by covering more live events? Or do you think that even that's not going to do it?
Well, there are AM stations in the country that are some of the most profitable stations in the country.
Oh.
And then there's lots of little mom-and-pop AM stations that are as a matter of fact, two of my clients, two of the 30 clients that I have turned off, they had at least one FM station that they were operating, and they turned off their AM stations just because they didn't think they could sell advertising on it. Honestly, a lot of that has more to do with a frame of mind. And if you find a niche that somebody wants to listen to, you can sell at least enough to keep the station going.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the proposals that the FCC is looking at, and I think probably we will see part of them come to fruition, is that right now some of the rules of one of the rules that actually was passed back in the late 90s, it's called the Ratchet Rule, that it was meant to decrease interference on the FM broadcast band. And it, in a very simplified version of it, is that if you are planning on moving or modifying an existing AM station, you have to reduce the interference to other stations, first, second, and I think third adjacent channels, by X number of percent. Well, what that did was it locked stations into having to stay on the piece of property that they were on forever, because as you probably know, most AM stations, well, radio stations in particular, but radio stations in general, but AM stations in particular, were built right on the outskirts of town.
Yeah.
40 years ago. And a lot of these little stations have found over the years that their transmitter site property is worth more to a developer than the station is as an operating radio station.
Yeah.
So they, over the years, we've built quite a number of stations that decided to just go find themselves another transmitter site, move out, build a transmitter site, new tower, ground system, and then continue on from there, sell their other property for maybe millions of dollars, except that this ludicrous ratchet rule, as it's called, is if they move over a certain distance from their existing, and it's like only 1 kilometer, I think, that you can move. It's very restrictive.
That, oh, wow.
If you move any further than that, then you have to add additional protection to your co-first and second, at least, if not third, adjacent channels. And what might have been a 1,000-watt station, if they moved 2 kilometers away from where they're at, they might have to drop to 500 watts.
Oh, yeah.
That dropped 500 watts to reduce interference to their frequency neighbors.
Yeah.
And that was done. It was a yet another of those government mandates where there was probably well-intentioned, but the law of unintended consequences, nobody really thought about going to be how bad they were hurting, especially the small stations. And you know, it's now almost impossible to move some AMs, and impossible to move many AMs. And if they abolish the ratchet rule, then and when I say ratchet, it's ratchet as in a snap-on ratchet. You know, they're going to ratchet down the interference.
Yeah.
It was not meant to do.
And okay.
If they abolish the ratchet rule, then that's going to allow a number of stations to move their facilities to someplace, possibly even where it's going to be would have better coverage for their intended listening audience, and not be penalized by having to reduce power to reduce interference to those co-first, second, and third adjacent channels. The other thing is that has always been a real problem is FCC says you have to, your daytime coverage has to cover a certain percent, and I think like almost 90 to 100% of the your city of license, of the population of your city of license. But you can get by with they drop it well on down, like 70% for your nighttime coverage. However, many of the cities that, especially the small cities that in the last 30 years or so have really, really grown, that's impossible to do.
Yeah.
There very possibly is not a transmitter site anywhere that will cover with like 1,000-watt AM that will cover that amount of the population.
Yeah.
We worked on a station. We built a station a number of years ago that had to get a special waiver. And the FCC's been pretty good about granting these waivers. But there again, that's more time, more money. You know, consultants and lawyers charge $5 for that for getting that done, but the FCC's been pretty good about granting it. But it was determined that there was, and this was back around 2000, I guess, that it was determined that at night, their nighttime coverage would not, period, would not cover the specified portion of the their city of license population. There was no transmitter site. And of course, they were moving. They were forced to move by an eminent domain project. But they could have moved, instead of being outside town, they could have moved right into the middle of the city, because the city was kind of figure eight shaped due to a river and tributaries and what have you that grew out to be very long but kind of narrow.
Yep.
And most of the population was at the outside extremes in the residential areas.
Yeah.
So they could cover one or the other of those areas easily enough, but not both. So that's they're also looking at doing away with that with the requirement to cover at least at night a large percentage of the city of life populations.
Oh, so the FCC is going to change our ruling? Is that what you're saying?
That's one of the many proposals that was put forth this spring in when they requested comments on it. So
okay.
Yeah, I'm going to say that's probably that, and removing the ratchet rule, and probably allowing a one-time window for FM station for AM stations to apply for an FM translator. I would say that's probably the top three that they will do, but, you know, we are talking about bureaucrats and a government agency, so sometimes it's kind of hard to relate exactly what is going to happen.
Hey, Kevin, I got to run here in a minute. I got to get in another call, but just to be clear, your company is KK Broadcast Company?
It is KK Broadcast Engineering and AM. Just the initials AM as in AM radio, ground systems company.
Okay. I have your website. I have the amgroundsystems.com. Is that what I have?
Yeah,
amgroundsystems.com. So I'll put that on my blog for you. get that out there, and I'll put your company names. I'll put both of them. And sorry, buddy. I'd love to keep talking because I love talking about this stuff. It's interesting, you know. I mean, you're living it, you know. You deal with it every day, so to me, it's interesting. And I guess you find it interesting because you've been doing it a while.
Yeah, I can't. Honestly, there's days where I would consider take up hatchet fighting as a vocation, but after I think about it, I just can't hardly imagine doing anything else. I've done pretty well all of my adult professional life, so I'm here for the long haul.
Hey, Kevin, thanks again. I do appreciate it. I really do. Sorry we couldn't hook
Anytime,
up a little
great
earlier.
Great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Kevin. Take care.
Okay, thank you. See you.
Bye.